Welcome to episode 437 of Death Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Manuel Sola Arjona, who is a cycling coach and former professional cyclist. He's the author of the book The Nature of Training and host of the podcast Rendimiento Evolutivo. I've been following Manuel for several years on Twitter. That's where I first learned about him and his work, and I've always enjoyed his thoughts and perspectives. And then not long ago, earlier this year, I believe, his book got translated into English from the original Spanish version. So I purchased that book, read it, and really, really loved it. I think actually it might well be the best and most important influential book about training that I've ever read. And today's discussion covers most of the important concepts discussed in the book, so you will get a great overview of it all. And then if you want to dig deeper, I would definitely encourage you to get the book. As I said, there haven't been many books that I've read in years about training that have influenced me in such a way as this one. I do want to mention before the interview that Manuel did a ton of work to prepare to do this interview in English, a language where he's not super comfortable. So first of all, massive kudos to him for having the courage to come on and still do an interview in English despite that. And because of that, we stuck to a list of questions quite strictly or very extremely strictly. So if there are some points where you think that the line of questioning on my part sounds a bit rigid and lacking follow-up or similar, then this is the reason why. We wanted Manuel to have the chance to prepare in advance for all of the questions I asked. So that's what we did. We stuck to the list of questions and that's it. The other thing that I want to say is that I think that for the most part, everything that Manuel says is very easily comprehensible. But if there are a few parts where you are unsure of something that was said, then I recommend that you go and look up the show notes for this episode on scientifictriathlon.com/TTS437. Of course, the show notes are not a full transcript, but all of the most important things that were said should be in there, at least in some abbreviated form. So use those show notes as a resource. I know that a lot of you do already, but this may be an episode where some that are not habitually using the show notes could consider benefiting from going and checking them out. So now, before we get into the interview with Manuel, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate and electrolyte products that are effective, practical, and tasty. One small but very important detail that I love about the Precision Fuel and Hydration products is that with the amounts of carbs and sodium in their products, it makes it super easy to keep track of what you consume. So before I found their products, this is now many, many years ago, I would, for example, race with gels that contained 22 or 23 grams of carbohydrate. And for one thing, I had to carry many more gels instead of using 30-gram or 90-gram gels that Precision Fuel Hydration have, but also just keeping track of the amounts when it's not a round, easy number like 30 is just a little bit more difficult, especially when you're really in the red zone in a race. So with the 30-gram gels and the 90-gram gels that Precision Fuel Hydration use, then it becomes really easy to keep track of, because it is a multiple of the standard recommendations for carb consumption during races, which you could use 60 grams or 90 grams or even 120 grams an hour. And it's very easy to hit that when you have gels that contain 30 grams of carbs or 90 grams of carbs. And the same goes for the sodium products. These things might be just sound like a small thing, but when you're in a race and your brain is not really at its full cognitive capacity, then I actually found that this made a huge difference in being able to stick to my plan. So I love this aspect of Precision Fuel and Hydration products, and I wanted to highlight it here. As a listener, you can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS24 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Indoor Swim Trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. For a lot of athletes, the limitation to swim training is that it can be very time-consuming to swim when you consider everything that goes into a swim, with commuting to the pool, all of the faff you may have to get through at the pool before actually getting into the water, and so on. This means that for a lot of people, it might only be realistic to swim once or twice per week, but with the Senate, you can complement that pool swimming with a quick and efficient home-based workout that challenges your swim-specific muscles, so you can increase that all-important frequency of training and give yourself a chance to keep improving your swimming even when your pool time is limited. You can try the Senate risk-free for 30 days and get 20% off your first order on zenitsintra.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with Manuel Sola Arjona. Welcome to the Triathlon Show, Manuel. How are you doing?
Fine. Thanks so much for having me. Sorry to the listeners, because my speaking, as you know, is not perfect in English. So I hope to do it fine, but sorry for my pronunciation.
I'm sure the listeners will be understanding. Let's start. If you can please introduce yourself to the audience, tell us a bit more about yourself.
Okay, I have competed in cycling since I was 14. I have competed in all categories, and cycling and racing has been my life. No, and also while competing, I studied sports science at the University of Granada, and later I did a master's in nutrition. But then I started training cyclists, and until now, I have always been obsessed with learning to improve. I wanted to learn to get better and improve my performance. But since I started cycling until now, I haven't stopped learning and practicing. In fact, every year I spend more time learning and training. No, I'm doing this for, I don't know, 18 years. This took a lot of thinking. No, and that's why I write the book. No, and that's why we are here. No. I was frustrated because I think that the more I learned it, the less certain I was about everything. And this is what led me to write my book, The Nature of Training.
Yeah, it's the classic Dunning-Kruger effect, that the more you learn, the more you realize that you don't know so much. So the book that you mentioned, it's called The Nature of Training, Complexity Science Applied to Endurance Performance. And can you explain, first of all, just the title of the book? Why is it the complexity science or complexity science applied to endurance performance? Why is it the nature of training?
Okay, that's a great question. Thank you. By nature, I don't mean a forest, but I mean everything that exists in the universe. No, it's like similar to the concept of Tao in Buddhism. Because complex systems are nested at different levels, and we are all dependent on each other. No? Atoms from molecules, molecules from cells, cells from organisms, communities, then ecosystem, planets. In the end, as I say in the book, there is only one complex system. No, I call it nature, and that's why I choose the title. No, because I think until now, humans have been studied as if they were separate from their environment. What I highlight with the title of the book is that the same laws and properties that govern system behavior also affect humans. And by understanding the laws of complexity, we can approach sport training or health more effectively.
Yeah, that is a good summary. So can we talk a little bit more about that for people that may never have? Of course, the complexity is a normal word, but what is complexity science? You mentioned complex systems. Can you explain a bit more what it is and how it relates to endurance performance?
Yes. Complexity science is a new field that comes from mixing different disciplines. It studies how unexpected behaviors and patterns show up in system with many interacting parts. We call this the complex system. Complex, the word, comes from the Latin word plexus, which means braided, intertwined, woven. And this refers to the relationship between the entire system, which makes it function as an integrated and inseparable whole. I like to say that thermodynamics can explain how living systems become dust, but it is not able to explain how dust becomes a living organism. So to understand this, we need complexity. Right? So complexity science has been used in fields like ecology, economic, or sociology. But if there is one system that's super complex, it's the human body. There is even a branch of complexity science that looks at adaptive complex systems, which can adapt because, for example, a hurricane is a complex system, for sure, but it doesn't adapt. It doesn't change to function well in cold ocean, for example. But it doesn't get mad and decide to go to the opposite direction. But a person can. And until now, we have tried to understand the body and improve it using an isolated and reductionist approach, which is like trying to understand how a forest works by studying only one type of tree.
Yeah, You mentioned there reductionism. So that basically means, just for the listeners, that, as you say, for example, studying one tree to understand the forest in human endurance performance, we can think about something like VO2 max and trying to understand human performance by just looking at VO2 max or something like that. I guess that's an example. Can you give some other examples of how reductionism appears in endurance sports and in sports science in general?
Okay. Let me start explaining that reductionism is a scientific approach that tries to find answers by breaking problems down into as many parts as possible and solving them separately to then try to understand the whole. And this approach is scientific and has been very successful in technology, for example, no, for creating increasingly sophisticated machines, but has a certain issues that make it problematic to understand complex systems. In the world of training, the challenge isn't finding samples of reductionism, but rather the opposite. Almost everything is reductionist to some extent because it's part of the biomedical model we are trained with. A good example of reductionism is extrapolating recommendation for athletes from studies that measure the effect of isolated markers far from real situations. Molecular physiology is a prime example of reductionism when misused, proposing training methods just because they activate a certain protein or increase a levels of a specific hormone. For instance, it reminds me of that study that claimed caffeine increased the rate of glycogen resynthesis and therefore could be suitable after exercise. I think that's been blinded by reductionism, because the goal isn't to increase glycogen resynthesis, no? It's to recover faster. And caffeine might help one parameter to improve at the expense of degrading dozens of others, no? Like making you sleep worse or preventing relaxation, keeping you from entering a more anabolic state, etc. There are hundreds of samples like this, because it's important to understand, I think, that we are not just mitochondria. We are not dopamine. We are not VO2 mass. We are not glucose spike. No? We are the interaction of all these things with our environment and our unique story. No? For example, another one, the concept of marginal gains has caused a lot of harm when has been misunderstood, because one indicator can improve at the expense of all the others getting worse. No, in fact, when we try to optimize one part of our body too much, it's usually at the cost of harming others.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary of and good, some good examples there with how if you focus on one parameter, for example, you might have an improvement in that parameter, but then that's not taking into account all of the other parameters that might be impacted. For example, sleep and recovery if you take caffeine after exercise, like you said. So just a bit more theory before we get into the practical questions. So in the book, you explain some of the key properties of complex systems. And so can you give us some examples of that? What are the key properties that we should be aware of that exist in any complex system, including us humans?
Okay, I love to talk about these properties. I would say that the main property of a complex adaptive system is emergence, which means that at each level, properties appear that are unimaginable through the behavior of the parts alone. A famous example is consciousness, which emerges from the electrochemical interaction of millions of neurons. Life itself is an emergent property arising from the union of different organelles and proteins within a cell. These emerging properties result from the synergies between parts and therefore cannot be observed or predicted only by studying each part separately. Self-organization occurs through processes of interaction, communication, and synchronization between each component of the system with its neighbors and the environment. And this process happens autonomously, autonomously, sorry, and variably according to the needs of the whole system, the current state of the network, for example, fatigue, strengths, weaknesses, or the person's history and learnings. Clear example of emerging self-organized processes are pedaling or riding technique or cadence. Because, for example, there isn't an ideal cadence or technique, as this vary depending on the person at the competition moment, because the state of the organism is different and requires different compensation. This self-organization process also happens internally in how different organs and systems contribute at any given moment to sustain the pace. For instance, the body can maintain very high intensity exercise despite the acidity generated by lactate accumulation due to the buffer effect created through respiration or the renal system, which can compensate for these acidity levels through changes in breathing and urine composition. This leads to another crucial property, circular causality, which means that the whole system interacts infinitely. Changes in the past modify the world, and changes in the whole modify sport. This means there isn't a simple cause and effect relationship in the body, because a cause can have multiple effects, which in turn become causes of future effects, interrelating everything and keeping the system in a state of dynamic stability. This feedback mechanism generates another property, which is the nonlinear behavior of the whole system. This means the magnitude of a disturbance and its effects don't have a stable relationship. For example, an athlete can accumulate training load and micro tears in muscles without apparent performance loss or injury. The muscle or the organism can maintain activity despite some damage through compensation and synergies, but at a certain point, the damage accumulates or becomes so great that the body can't cope and injury or damage appear. No? For example, in a race, the stride that tears an athlete's hamstring is indistinguishable from the thousand or million of previous strides. And lastly, maybe my favorite property, which is unique to dynamic complex system, is that the goal of the system determines its functioning. Adaptive systems can modify their internal functioning to achieve their goals. No? For example, a person's cortisol levels or blood pressure are very different if they are relaxed and ready or if they are anxious and ready to run.
Yeah, no, that's a great overview of the properties of complex systems and good examples of how that also can manifest in endurance sports. One other topic that you mentioned in the book that I found very interesting is you draw some connections between evolution and training. So can you discuss why and how there are these connections and how you apply or you might apply an evolutionary perspective to training?
Okay. Organizing, including humans, we are not designed by a creator, but have adapted through evolution to fit our ecological needs. This means there is no human designer, but rather the function we need to survive has shaped our physiological workings. In my book, I say function is more important than form, because if we understand the stimuli human has evolved to respond to, we can provide this stimuli regardless of our detailed knowledge of individual physiology. For example, hunter-gatherers didn't need studies to give their bodies the optimal dose of exercise, the best food, circadian synchronization, and so on. No? They didn't need any of this because their bodies adapted to thrive in that environment. In terms of training, we know we still have the same genes and physiology as hunter-gatherers, so our bodies are primed to respond well to this evolutionary stimuli. We know a lot about the stimuli our bodies have adapted to and thus respond well to. For example, Homo sapiens, we are not particularly fast, no strong or agile. No, Usain Bolt is slower than a cat. We turn slowly and we are weaker than chimpanzees. No, we lack clones and fungs. Our only physical strength lies in endurance. We are much more endurant than other primates, especially in hot condition, as working on two less exposures, less surface area to solar radiation, and we are among the few mammals that can sweat to cool down. That's why we know that long duration, low intensity exercise was dominant in our evolution, and is what we are adapted to. Probably this is why successful endurance athletes do large volumes of training at low intensity, because it's in our genes. Another important point from evolution is that the contextualized strength training doesn't seem to make much sense. The strength exercise they did, our ancestors, were explosive and within natural movements. No? For example, throwing, fighting, climbing, jumping, or sprinting. Sprinting is also maximum strength work, as each stride involves applying the maximum possible force. No? Well, there are many more aspects I cover in a chapter on the book. Well, what is clear to me is that this stimuli should be the basis of our training, because they provide health and can be sustained for months, years, or a lifetime without causing injuries or imbalance.
Yep, thank you. That's a good overview. So now let's move into some practical application and how to apply some of these concepts in training. So if we start, can you just give an overview of your training methods and maybe also if you can highlight how it's different than some of the, maybe if it's different than what people commonly do today or what you see that other people do, maybe.
Okay. I think I could define my training method as the pursuit of that tricky dynamic balance between giving our body the stimuli it needs to stay healthy and those stimuli that help us improve in the specific activities required by competitive sport. Because if you focus too much on being a complete and healthy athlete, you won't achieve a spectacular performance in the sport, which is what most people hire you for. But if you focus too much on the specific part, you might perform well in the short term until the imbalance caused by excessive non-adaptative stimuli make your performance drop or lead to illnesses and injuries. I have also moved away quite a bit from the traditional periodization models or training method prescription based exclusively on the intensity as we train. Another aspect I find super important is that training should be co-directed between the coach and the athlete. Because like in a good synergy, the collaboration between the athlete and the coach is greater than the sum of both separately. No, because the coach has something that athlete needs, which is theoretical and practical core knowledge of human physiology and the training process, as well. Also, a decision-making ability that isn't clouded by emotions, but at the same time, the athlete has something the coach doesn't. No, it's the ability to know their feelings, our fears, preferences, and motivations. And since we know that trusting the plan and enjoyment are super important pieces of adapting to training, it doesn't make sense to leave them out, no? Because the training process is dynamic. No? We have a starting point, which is the athlete's current state, and a destination, which are our short, medium, or long-term goals. But between those two points, the path is uncertain, and we have to adjust as we go. No, it's about dancing with the system instead of having a rigid plan, because the same training that makes you improve today or in one contest can make you worse tomorrow in another contest.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I actually just spoke with an athlete earlier today about how I had some personal experience with the same training working really well for 2 weeks, but then the third week, it causes me to get worse and slower. So that's a good overview. Thank you. And another topic that you discuss is using RPE, rating of perceived exertion, to prescribe training and to do training. Can you discuss why you are a fan of RPE?
RPE, perception, sensation, are evolutionary tools that help us make the right decisions based on what our bodies need. We can tell when we are hungry or thirsty. We feel tiredness, pain, swelling, fever, and so on. No? Even emotions like fear, anger, or sadness push you to do things that help us survive in the past. Well, in exercise, as you say, we use something called effort perception, will mainly help us keep the right pace without burning out, no? Because without this effort perception, our ancestors won't have know how to pace themselves while hunting or gathering, and they could have ended exhausted or spending too much energy. To listeners, and to put it simply, I like to explain the perception of effort as a high-tech processor that monitors stress data affecting our whole body in real time and weighted them based on how much they affect us at a moment at the importance of the task at hand. Plus, this processor has a bit of machine learning because it learns from every action. No, so now it's pretty cool. But RPE isn't the only perception we use for training. No, we can sense fatigue, pain, mood, stress, and we can turn this perception into numbers using scales to make decisions, although this can lose some details. In sport, I think we rely too much on what our gadgets tell us. No, I get it. No, so in an uncertain world, it feels good to have a sad looking data to hold on to because it gives us a peace of mind. But we need to be aware of the limits and that they are only measure part of the system and with some error margin. Because, for example, no, a drop in your blood lactate might mean you are working out with less effort, or it could mean you are burning more fatty acids because you are more tired. You can be stronger in squat and have less power on the bike, or you can lower your fat percentage and still lose performance. No? So it's not about focusing on what happens on one parameter alone, but about what happens to all of you. No? So it's a big mistake, in my opinion, to neglect this new natural mechanism and rely on a bridge run to tell us when to train based on simple indicators that often don't hold up scientifically. No? So we need to reconnect with our bodies and learn to listen ourselves.
Yeah, no, that's good. And if you prescribe an interval session to an athlete, so this would be designed to improve performance, how do you do that? Do you give them some RPE target, this is how it should feel, or do you give a combination of power, RPE? Tell us a bit more about that.
Okay, let me start saying that a big problem with how training is prescribed is the idea that we can control adaptation through the applied stimuli. And that's just not true. No? We can control the stimuli, but what happens in the body afterward is hard to predict, no? Practically speaking, I use that the training stimuli depends on three factors. It is one type, two magnitude, and three frequency. And they all influence each other, no? One, with the type of stimuli refers to which physiological structure are mainly stimulated. For example, a high intensity stimuli of less than 10 seconds focuses more on fast fibers, motor neurons, phosphocreatine, while the low intensity stimuli like light pedaling affect slow fiber, oxidative phosphorylation, lipolysis, etc. Well, the type of stimuli can depend on intensity, but also on other accompanying factor. Now, the effect of a type of stimuli depend on the magnitude with which is applied. For example, the same low intensity stimuli, for example, some two, can be of low magnitude, for example, 30 minutes, or very high magnitude, 6 hours. And as the magnitude increase, more physiological structures are stimulated. No? For instance, if we maintain zone 2 for those 6 hours of pedaling, we start having cardiac drift, so faster fibers are also activated. There is higher oxygen consumption, higher catecholamine levels, more fatty acid oxidation, more need to thermoregulation, more stress in the renal system, catabolism, muscle damage. No? So it indeed is being more systemic. No? And the third factor is frequency, no? Which is how often we stimulate the body. Frequency and magnitude interact with each other, because the greater the magnitude of the stimuli, the less frequently we can repeat it, and vice versa. So when training, I focus on what type of stimuli I want to create and with what magnitude. Stimuli types aren't always metabolic. No, we can also play with training head, altitude, aero position, technique, high or low in carbohydrates, and so on. No, metabolically, for example, I separate the stimuli into 4 types, no? Which is aerobic capacity, intensity we can maintain more than 1 hour, more or less, aerobic power, intensity we can maintain between 3 and 60 minutes, anaerobic capacity, intensities we can maintain between 30 seconds and 3 minutes, and neuromuscular power. Once you choose the type of stimuli, you determine the magnitude, no? And this can be gauged by the maximum effort per session you experience during intervals. Well, and regarding low-intensity training, I like to base it on heart rate or perceived effort, because there are internal load metrics showing what's happening in the body, no? If you train some two by POA and use watts based on a test you did when fresh, after several hours, you will be working at much higher internal load that you want. No? You will be in a higher intensity domain. And the body doesn't understand watts. It understands stimuli or stress, no? Heart rate or perceived effort, taking into account accumulated fatigue, head, deshydration, and lack of glycogen. And will be higher if you maintain the watts stable, no? So if your goal is to stay below the first threshold, these metrics are much more suitable, no? And plus, they're making the training more enjoyable and easy to follow, no? Keeping a stable power for hours is boring and doesn't allow you to enjoy the scenery or to go with people, no? It can be even dangerous. And science hasn't been proven that there is any benefit to training at constant speed all the time. Maintaining power doesn't make sense from an evolutionary perspective. I don't see the point of keep doing it.
When you said about the high intensity, when you choose the magnitude, you said that you can choose the magnitude of the stimulus based on the... Did you say that you choose the magnitude based on the perception of effort? So you're basically... Maybe you tell me that I should have my perception of effort should be that I can do 1 more interval at the end, or that I can do 2 more intervals, or that I can do 0 more intervals, that it was all out. Is that a bit how you decide the magnitude, or can you give some specifics around that?
Okay, there's 2 things here, no? One is how to measure the magnitude. For me, I measure 2 RPE. One is the average RPE of the training. For example, no? When you do a 4 hours long ride, you 1 hour later, you say, well, my RPE of the training was 5 or 6. Another is the maximum RPE that you have in the sets. No, for example, if you want to train aerobic power and do 3 sets of 8 minutes at the power you can maintain for 20 minutes, no, for 20 minutes, the RPE might be 7, 8, and 9 in the last set. No? But in this case, the magnitude of the stimuli is a 9 out of 10, no? Meaning it made you work at 90% of your maximum. Well, and to decide what kind of magnitude of the I want to do. I need to be very careful looking at what the athlete can recover based on the previous week, no, or previous training sessions. But also, it is hard to explain, no, but also, in, for example, for me, in the base period, when we focus more on health, normally I don't like to do sessions that give you exhausted and you can recover maximum in 40 hours. No, so we stay in 8, 7, 8, maybe 9 one day in the week, but we try not to go more than that. And then in the specific period when we are looking to race, we try to do the intervals days more harder, no, looking for go to 9 or even 10 out of 10 of effort per session in 2 days or maybe 3 days in the week, because we want to feel the effort, the pain, and the maximum adaptation looking for the race, even if we know that these kind of intervals are not suitable to do for long periods because it leads all to overtrain. But in a specific period, I prescribe harder sessions, but with more recovery between them. So we train some days more easy and some days more hard, no, more polarized. And in base session, in base weeks, the training is more homogeneous, no, it's more stable. No super hard days, but no so many recovery.
Understood. Can you discuss your thoughts on, you already discussed a little bit, but do you have any other thoughts on recovery and adaptation to training?
Well, as I say in the book, for me, a well-designed training program flow smoothly and is easy to follow, because if we are doing it right, we will train hard when we are ready and slow down when we are tired. So I'm not saying we should never train when we are tired or motivated, but generally, this day should be rare and we should know they are part of the plan, because our perception are an ancient mechanism that help us understand the state of our body and when we need to rest and when we can push. Also, I think people get obsessed following silly training load metrics and training more and more, but the relationship between training load and progress isn't proportional, nor linear or stable. At least this thing that metrics like CTR or what Strava call fitness are measures of their real fitness level, but they really just show what you are training more, no, that you are improving more. Obviously, for people who don't train well, increasing the load improves performance because they go from not training to training. But for experienced and well-trained athletes, the link between training load and performance disappear. Also, I would add that in my work as a coach, I see that most athletes are overtrained because they don't manage the load well and keep thinking that more training is better. And this isn't true and never has been. Training is another stress to the body, and too much stress without enough recovery only leads to damage. So if you notice, most people do 4-6 month training cycles where they train hard and improve fastly, because they feel better and fresher, they keep training hard and harder until they reach a point where they plateau or get injured or sick and end up needing a break. And they live in a constant loop where they lose what they gain in a few months because they lack patience and miss out on the benefit of long-term and chronic adaptation to training.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And do you have any thoughts on training zones? You mentioned how you use training zones, but training zones and thresholds and how they are used, any things to keep in mind with that?
Okay, I need to explain a little bit more to say my point. In exercise, We think there is a steady state because critical power or FTP models are based on an hyperbolic function. For example, MFTP is defined as the highest power a cyclist can sustain in a quasi-state state without fatiguing, lasting approximately an hour.
Just one point here for the listeners. MFTP is how WKO, the software, estimates FTP. So if somebody is not familiar with MFTP, it's basically the same as FTP, but it's estimated based on the power curve. So sorry, go on.
Yeah, exactly. It's like more or less a copy of critical power model. No, and critical power is defined by two ways. No, the modern way is the transition between heavy and severe domains, but it also has been described as an asymptote of the power time relationship function. No, but I think there is no asymptote. The belief that there is an intensity below which we fatigue much more slowly, I think it's a misinterpretation of the power-time relationship. Of course, the lower the pace, the longer it takes to fatigue. And this is exponential, no? Which means that if we lower power by 10%, the time we can maintain it increases not only 10%, but much more, no? So in my book, I argue that the function that best model the relationship between power or speed and the time we can sustain it is a power law. Power laws don't have thresholds. No, in fact, looking at world athletic records, there is no change in the power law modeling the speed time curve from 1500 meters to the marathon when we weighed in a logarithmic scale. No? Also, a month ago, we started a scientific article with Frederic Sabater and Staden Khaled Irati to try and gather data from more people and publish it. But the important thing is that the loss of power or speed is proportional, similar from short efforts to long ones. No? For example, in cycling, we have seen that more or less, it depends on the person, but more or less for every tripling of sustained time, the power we can maintain drops by 8 or 10%. No? So this means, for example, that if you can push 400 watts in 5 minutes, you would expect to push around 360 watts for 15 minutes, 324 watts for 44 minutes, and so on. No? If there is no stable point in behavior, no, in power or in speed, why do we think that it is internally? Well, I think we can measure many parameters that have a point where the trend changes, no, a threshold, like lactate, oxygen consumption, respiratory rate, catecholamines, etc. But in the body, everything is constantly fluctuating. No? So imagine now watching the tour. No? We see Pogacar and Vingegaard attacking each other repeatedly. We see Vingegaard setting a heat pace under the finish with Pogacar close behind, and these two titans are giving their all. They pass all thresholds, if not all. No, they change their pedaling pattern, their substrate usage, oxygen consumption, lactate levels, etc. But they keep pedaling the same pace. No, so if we watch cycling for the outside without the mental model of thresholds and steady states, you can think or imagine about their existence. In reality, I think there is only one real threshold. No? When we see the athlete, the global, no, is the point where the athlete can sustain the pace and has to lower intensity. No? That's the only threshold we can see. So to me, thresholds are markers of the depletion of some physiological structure involving an exercise and signals that new ones will start to take over. No? So they are related to fatigue, of course, but they aren't the causes of fatigue. Not all athletes have the same thresholds at the same intensity percentage. No? In example, different athletes can sustain very different times at each threshold. So considering this, we realize that thinking there are significant changes when moving from one song to another song makes no sense, no? Because songs, in the end, should be seen as what they are, artificial limits we set in intensities to create our models and research. But in reality, they don't exist, no? It's like separating studies by birth year, no? At some point, a separation has to be made. But a child born in December and one in January of the following year are more similar than the later to another born in the autumn of the same year. So for that, I don't use songs, although I understand they can be useful for some coaches as long as they know what they are and don't fall into the trap of thinking that song edges are truly physiological limits.
I think that last point is a very good point. So I'm just going to repeat it to make sure that everybody takes that message home. So basically, zones can be useful, thresholds even can be useful, but as long as you understand that it's an artificial boundary in a way. It's not when you if your MFTP in WKO is 300 watts, your training at 290 watts and 310 watts isn't going to make a very substantial difference. It's just that you can do a bit more training below and a bit less training above. And but for people that are more interested in things like the power law discussion and some of the mathematical concepts that you described, which I think were very well explained in the book, so I definitely recommend checking that out. It was one of the parts of the book that I found really interesting. And another simple thing that people can do is to, in WKO, try to toggle between logarithmic scale and linear scale and see how that changes the way that they view thresholds, because it does come down to potentially being a bit artificial. Another example is, as you say, different systems compensate for each other. So if you measure your ventilatory threshold, it's going to be different than your lactate threshold because they are just different systems, but they collaborate to achieve the same speed, as you say. Maybe Vingegaard is above his respiratory threshold and Pogacar is below, but they ride the same speed and maybe they have different strengths in different systems. But I guess a bit of a rambling about some of the things that I take away from listening, but I think it's a really important point that you made and a really good overview. But let's move on to the next question. And so can you discuss a bit the impact of psychology in the training process and the adaptation process?
Well, it's great, no? Because it's a crucial part of performance. At the end of the day, in a race or training session, we don't slow down because our lactate is high or because our heart rate is up or because our muscles hurt, no? We slow down when we can't bear the effort any longer, regardless of those indicators, no? And this, of course, sorry, this doesn't mean that willpower can do us to keep going forever, no? Because the sensation of effort is involuntary and is largely mediated by physical stress. But however, there is a significant amount of motivation involved in the decision to continue or stop, no? It would be foolish not to train this aspect as it can improve performance as much as or even more than physical training, no? Because we can improve our ability to endure effort in three areas, no? One, physical part, no? Which is training to improve, to generate less physical damage. This part is what everyone thinks about training. But there is two more, no? The second one is the emotional part, no? Because increasing motivation to keep going because the goal is bigger. And three, the rational part, no? Improving willpower to continue even when we feel like stopping, which is about mindset. Well, the level of motivation depends on both the person activation and their degree of attraction or aversion to the task. When the task is motivating and we are excited about it, we feel less effort under the same physiological stress, and vice versa when the task is unappealing or we are not engaged. One way to improve motivation is by setting goals that are ambitious enough to be motivating us, but not so much that they become unrealistic. If we feel we can't achieve them, our motivation will drop suddenly. Mindset is the rational part of the tree. No? It's the ability to consciously decide to endure more or less effort. And I like to explain mindset as a negotiation between the benefits we think a task will give us and the cost involved. This negotiation is dynamic, no? As the perception of benefit and cost depends on our thoughts. No? Everyone who has competed has experienced this. No? What seems like a reasonable deal at rest, no? Or at the start of the race, for example, to endure 40 minutes of effort in exchange for a personal best in a race, might not seem so acceptable when you are actually experiencing it, no? Leading you to slow down. I would say that at rest, everyone is very brave, no? So we can imagine the epic fears and distant attacks we will see in popular races if we stuck to our pre-race plans. And lastly, there is a mental technique to help endure a bit longer during those critical moments, which can change your outcome. But there are no magic techniques. Tolerance to effort is trained, and the most important thing is to have clear goals and experience these different types of effort in training or in races and try to endure them more and more each time.
Yeah, that's a good summary. And of course, coming back to a bit the main topic of complexity, if we're talking about complex systems, then it's not just about the physical, but also about the psychological. And so we have to consider that in training, and it's a very important part. Then what about the environment? I think that can have an impact on psychology, but also on physiology and the physical. So do you have any thoughts on the training environment and if that's something that we should consider?
For example, biologists know well that a species cannot be studied separately from its habitat, no? Because its physiology and even its behaviors change as the environment changes, no? For example, no, the same pine tree that can reach 40 meters in a valley would be a creepy shrub in the high mountains. No, so humans are often studied in isolation from the habitat. No, we are the only animal that is studied in isolation from the habitat. No, like if we were a machine instead of a primate. That's why we focus so much on studying factors that are insignificant, but within the social context we live in, no? I say sometimes, no, Pogacar wouldn't be Pogacar, wouldn't have won the Tour if he had been born in Nigeria, no? But because human beings, we are not robots, no? We are open systems that interact and share matter and information with the environment, no? We constantly exchange energy, atoms, and molecules with our surrounding. And part of the environment becomes part of us, like food, bacteria, or volatile substances. So I don't think it's a coincidence, no, that most the great endurance champions come from rural areas. No, it's not a coincidence. And it's not only molecules, but also information, because for our bodies to function well, all the physiological changes that occur through the day need to be synchronized with each other and with the environment. No? This is what happens, for example, when our circadian cycles are well synchronized. And the environment also encompasses social relationships and the culture of our society. No? If I am not happy, my body does not function well. No? If you have anxiety, your body will not adapt to training in the best way. And many athletes will improve much more if they spend more time with their friends instead of training a lot more.
Yeah, I think another example that I can think of here is training camp. For many amateur athletes, when you're working at home and you have the work and family to take care of, you can maybe train 10 hours and Beyond that, it might be too much. Obviously, this is individual, but that's quite common that 10 hours is doable. More than that, and it's too much. Then you go to a training camp. You're in a warm place, sun, great riding. You have friends around you. You don't have to work. You don't have your family there. Maybe you go on a solo trip. You can suddenly train 25 hours and still feel better, adapt to that training better than a normal week. So I think that it's just a very important thing to remember that how much the environment matters.
Yeah, 100%. I have experienced it also when I was racing. I remember having a lot of races in summer, then going to altitude. And I only wanted to go to my house, stay with my friends. I was sad, no? I didn't want to stay in altitude. And my performance will drop it because my body wasn't happy, no? Because, for example, the stress, the cortisol levels were so high that they dampened the adaptation of training.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on artificial intelligence, big data, wearables and technology? This is a broad question, but any thoughts on that related to what we have been discussing?
Yeah, I love this question because it's of actuality, no? And I think it's clear we are moving towards an era where the advantage won't be in having more data than others, but in having the right paradigm to understand and integrate all the data. Because big data, AI, machine learning, they only correlate variables, but extrapolating what's best on average to the specific case of each individual is very difficult, almost never suitable. No? What we really need is not to find more correlation, but causations, no? To know what a person needs at each moment and why they need it, no? And that's the tricky part, because the number of factors influencing how a person adapts is almost unmanageable, no? Physiological and genetic factor, their previous training, genetics, motivation, physiology, emotional state, culture. So there are so many factors that don't always have the same weight and don't relate to each other in the same way for any two people. No? So there is no ideal or average athlete. No? Each body self-organizes according to all these factors. And if you compare data from one person in each area with the average and think that improving what's below average will improve the whole, it won't happen. And on top of that, some things can be measured well, no? Your training load in previous years, the global effect of training, mental stress, genetics, microbiome, fears, desires. No matter how much you scale them, information is always lost. So I think every time a new technology appears, we think it will revolutionize the training world. But we stay the same. It's always the same cycle. No, there is a hype phase where it seems controlling the measure variable will give us total control over the body, and then it gradually proves not to be the case. No, and maybe it hasn't had time yet. No, but I would say I'm here for real-time lactate monitors to become popular, so people will realize it's not that important. No, because if it weren't expensive and difficult to measure, we would probably just use a heart rate, for example. Finally, I want to say that I think that I worry that AI might help perpetuate all minds, no? Because models, language models say what we want them to say. And when we start thinking what they say, no, what ChatGPT say, if we think it is reality, it will be hard to keep progressing and break outdated paradigm.
Yeah, I think the point about looking back at new technology and whether it revolutionized or not, that's a good lesson from history. Did, for example, continuous glucose monitors revolutionize training? No, not even power meters revolutionized, even though that's one of the technologies that has been, I think, very useful. But it's not, I don't think that the cyclists have that much more power. They might be a bit it might be better to pace when you have a power meter, to pace your effort in a time trial, for example. But in terms of training, getting strong, we don't really have. It's not that technology doesn't help; it does definitely help. But we also need to be kind of realistic about how much it helps. And so, yeah, that's a good point. Finally, a few general questions. First of all, what do you think are the most common mistakes made by endurance athletes and or coaches?
Well, I could say more or less the same for athletes and coaches. But for example, on athletes, especially athletes who doesn't have a coach, the big mistake could be, for example, bad daily habits, no, because they focus only on training and maybe on nutrition, but they ignore circadian rhythms, stress or anxiety, their exposure to pollutants, etc. Also, overtraining, sure, no, because most athletes I work with were overtraining before, no. It's a shame that we fall into this trap due to poor advice or because the urge or to do more. Thirdly, I would say copying others, no. There is no one size fits all approach, and even when copying works, it's often for reasons that we don't understand, no. And this includes to copying the professional. And to coaches, I would say the big problems are firstly too much specificity in training, because specificity is a drag because it gives you quick improvement in the short term, but in the long term, it leads to stagnation or injuries, no? In Spain, we say, breathe for today, hunger for tomorrow. Second, I would say a problem in coaches are following rigid recipes and plans, no? I sometimes... coaches seems like they are following wheat crash recipes from dubious books produced out of tradition, no? Sticking to rules is convenient, but wrong. We need to understand that there is no manual or perfect way to do training. Finally, I would say relying on data that they don't understand, because many confuse metrics with goals and finish focusing on improving FTP or CTL or any program given metrics instead of thinking about adaptation, fatigue, and performance.
Yeah, great summary. And can you give three pieces of advice to listeners that they can use to improve their endurance training or cycling training?
Yes. I would say, first of all, enjoy the training process, no? Because there are too many ways to skin a cat. You don't have to do specific intervals over others, and running or cycling at a steady pace isn't always better than mixing it up. There are lots of ways to adjust your training to routes you enjoy and to be able to go out with friends. In the end, champions are champions because they have been training nonstop for decades. And to achieve this, you need to enjoy the training and the lifestyle that comes with being an athlete. Another one, the same, forget about many metrics, because metrics can make you focus on important things or even lead to training mistakes. For instance, being obsessed by hitting a certain fitness number can prevent you from considering how you actually feel this day and how you are responding to training, no? Understanding what metrics mean, the pros and cons, isn't easy, and most people are stuck trying to train everything without really knowing what's going on. And the third one, I think, is think about the big picture and avoid over-optimizing, because performance isn't just a sum of factors, but the interaction between all of them. For example, I often say, it is good to go out with friends and have a few glasses of wine. Pues sometimes yes, because if you obsess over rest and sleep and train, you might end up feeling sad or stressed, you know, which is much worse for performance. I'm not saying do everything, but we should not forget that we are people with feelings and needs beyond training. No, what's important is staying in the game for the long haul.
100%. Very good advice. And I want to mention as well that you have a podcast in Spanish, Rendimiento Evolutivo. But other than your book, The Nature of Training, and your podcast, do you have any other resources to recommend? This could be books, podcasts, YouTube channels that people, listeners today that are interested in what we have been discussing, where they can find some more thoughts, some more information about these topics, or just general recommendations for these kinds of resources.
Well, there is incontable people or authors that I offer the creation of the book and my ideas, but I will say some books because I love books, no? Because I think books is the way that authors try to convey their accumulated knowledge in the most organized, condensed, and engaging way possible, no? Often putting together ideas scattered across many disconnected papers, no? To listeners, I will recommend some books that I think they are the most important books to understand or my mind, no? And I would say, for example, well, first of all, Nassim Taleb, because with all of all his book, because he's my reference author. Also, I find very interesting other books like How Nature Works by Peter Back, Scale by Geoffrey West, Exercise It by Lieberman, Thinking in System by Donella Meadows, The Book of Why by Judea Pearl, Endure by Alex Hutchinson. And a pair of books I would recommend because I am very happy to have do the complexity courses from the Santa Fe Institute. Some of them are even free.
That's very nice. Nassim Taleb was the first author you mentioned, and I want to highlight in particular his book Anti-Fragile. I think that's an exceptionally good and useful book for it's not a sports book, of course, but for life, basically. So that one I can definitely recommend strongly from my side as well. And finally, where can people follow you? Do you have social media or things like that? Any other recommendations for following you and your work?
Well, first of all, no, if they like the interview, even when my English is not very good, they can learn more in my book, The Nature of Training, which is available on Amazon. I also set up a newsletter in Substack where I will be sharing reflection and articles about training. No, the address is Sol Arjona, with my surnames altogether, .substack.com. Well, also, if they're looking for my name, I have Twitter, Instagram, but normally, my publications are in Spanish, so it would be good way to practice another language.
Yeah, that's an excellent way, for sure. And also with translation in the browsers, it's pretty easy to get a decent translation these days. But thank you so much, Manuel. It's been really great to have this chat. And again, I loved your book, can strongly recommend it to everybody, and I appreciate having this talk. So I hope to speak to you again another time.
Thank you so much, Michael. I listen almost every podcast you publish, so I hope to thank you so much for what you are doing.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, and we'll have links to Manuel's website, social media, his book, of course, his podcast, and his Substack newsletter. So check out all those resources, but in particular, check out the book, The Nature of Training. For me, it has to be one of, if not the most influential training book that I have read, so I really strongly recommend it. There are many highlights and takeaways that we could discuss from an episode like this, but the one that I want to bring up is that when we're dealing with complex systems, including humans and human performance, then examining just the components or parts of that system in isolation and then trying to put it all together is a risky business. It is a reductionist approach that often misses critical interactions and dependencies within a system. So that's kind of a fancy way of saying that don't miss the forest for the trees, which is not news to anybody. It's something that we've talked about many times before here. But I think that for me, at least, I have really found it interesting to just scratch the surface a bit of learning about the intricacies of the science of complexity to better appreciate that not missing the forest for the trees saying and advice. It allows me to better appreciate why prioritizing a systemic perspective of performance or integrative perspective of performance is probably a better path to improving performance, or for that matter, even health, rather than zooming in too much on very specific details with a narrow lens. That's not to say that there's not a time and place for doing that, but it just gives you, I guess, a way of prioritizing things a little bit better. So I think that that's my takeaway, that with any complex system, not getting too caught up with reductionist approaches and zooming in on the components, because there are so many interactions and dependencies between the components of the system. So hopefully that makes sense, but if it doesn't, then you can just translate that into don't miss the forest for the trees. Now I want to promote our coaching and training plans a little bit, so check out all of the services and products we offer on scientifictriathlon.com. And I'm going to read a recent coaching review that we got for one of our coaches. This one is from an athlete that qualified for their professional license, but keep in mind that we work with athletes of all levels and we place equal focus on all athletes, no matter what level you are at. As always, when reading these reviews, I replace the name of the coach with simply coach. So the review goes, coach helped a lot to develop and helped me a lot to develop and mature as an athlete. I always had big goals of being competitive and eventually becoming a professional, and coach helped me improve a lot and achieve these goals. I made quite a few jumps on my bike and run. Power numbers that used to be insanely hard became comfortable, and I ran paces I didn't really think I could. The swim also improved a lot, and I certainly gained a lot of pool fitness, just struggling a little bit with translating that into triathlon races. The communication was perfect, even though we had quite a big time zone difference, and the frequent video calls definitely helped us build a great relationship. So if you're interested in working with a coach holistically to improve your performance, build a great coach-athlete relationship, then check out more information about how our coaching works on scientifictriathlon.com. Click through to the coaching page, and you can email me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com to learn more and to set up a free discovery call. In the next episode, we have a Q&A. I'll bring on Lachlan Kieran, one of our coaches, as co-host. We already have all the questions for that episode selected, but there will be more Q&As coming out semi-regularly. So please keep sending in your questions. I store all of them in a database and then pick from that database when it's time to do a new Q&A. And I do want to say that the questions tend to have a very good chance of getting answered. It's not quite 100%, but the majority of questions that get sent in do get answered eventually, even if it's not all of them, and even if it's not immediate, because obviously I don't do a Q&A episode every single week or so, but we get to the questions over time. Big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. There are a range of options from drink mix to gels to choose, so you can easily find your personal favorite. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS24. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Swim Trainer is a great tool to have in your toolbox to improve your technique and power, to target specific aspects of your stroke, and to maintain consistency when you don't have time to get to the pool. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.